think it's hard to not to emphasise just how important it is to develop stillness in the way that we just practiced then. Because I think from the Buddhist perspective, the stillness is really just so important, because not only is it really just still, you can look at the stillness in so many different ways, because it's actually really pure consciousness that we're looking at there, pure consciousness. And you can see that as something that's empty, it's emptiness, and it's also spaciousness. Actually, it's very analogous to even like the space in this room, or the space that's in the universe, in fact. That's is really the way that that is. It's very energetic, very energetic. The space in the universe even has a component in it that they call zero point energy, so that any point of space that you look at has this really infinite energy that's there, whether you're looking at a vast tract of it or whether it's just a very fine focused part of space. It has this tremendous energy, and you can sort of notice that. You can start to see that as you become more attuned to that stillness in your mind, that pure consciousness that is just there feeding back all of the time, going round and round. Just in the same way that if you put a microphone in front of a loudspeaker, how you get that squeal when it feeds back. That feeding back process is really happening there, because it's coming back into the present moment. And I just say that with the conviction that I do, in that we can sort of see, and we all know, I think, that we're looking at the present moment here as something that's very real. Really, it's the present moment is the only place where there is reality. I think we basically all know that, even though it's sometimes hard to just appreciate what that means. But we all kind of know that the past is gone and finished. I mean, the past certainly shapes the future, and shapes the present. But the past is in effect finished and gone. And the future, because it's not here yet, it's not really, there's no reality there either. The only reality that we always have, we only ever have really, is just this reality of the present moment, this right here and now. And that, I really just wanted to start the talk tonight by just acknowledging Ajahn Santucci a couple of weeks ago, when he gave that gave really a charming talk here. Really, his maiden talk here at Dharmaloka. But he was very, very honest in the way that he was sort of talking about his practice, and he was talking about this fear that comes, this when you start to look into this, what sort of feels like the abyss, that stillness can sometimes provide for you. When you're kind of looking at it, you can get sometimes this fear, because we're so used to things happening, so used to the conditions that we've developed in our mind, and then all of a sudden, you know, there's nothing there. And I mean, I know that any of you that have practiced meditation, when you've been on meditation retreats and so on, and you get to a place like this where you kind of come right up to the edge of what it is, and you, oh, geez, I'm not going to go down there, I'm not going to go in there. And he kind of explained that very, very lovely. And I trust you all kind of have had some experience with that, just where you... you know, there's this fear that sort of comes when your mind sort of settles to that level, settles to the so that you've got the ability to actually notice and see that. And that's something that we really all have to work with, I think, especially as lay people. I mean, when monks and nuns can do this, they've got sort of a full-time practice to do this. But as lay people, we've got to really come at it a little bit differently, because we've got other things that distract us in our lives. We can't sort of necessarily come to that all of the time. But nonetheless, it's so important, really, to to allow yourself to gradually and gently incline towards that stillness, just to make that stillness part of your being, to really know it. Like for those of you now who can still perhaps sense the resonance, just experience that resonance if it's there for you now. Just to know it. And it's really interesting to know that that can be there with all the conditions in the world too. It's just there all of the time. It's actually something that's seen quite simultaneously with the conditions of our life, because this still consciousness is really what shapes everything, what shapes the whole universe in the way that it is. So, yeah, with Venerable Santuti, I was really sort of pleased that he was talking about that, because it's important for us to see. I wanted to just tell you the story. I mean, I've told this before, actually, in the talks that I've given before, but I did want to talk about the death of my wife. Just something a little personal to share with you. This is my first wife, Diane, who died in 2007. And she died of breast cancer. But I was lucky enough to sort of be with her right up to the time that she died. And it was, when I think back on the experience, it was really one of the most wonderful experiences of my life, actually, just to, because she was just so so present at the time of her death. But it didn't start off that way. It was, you know, about 3 or 4 weeks out. I can remember that she was really quite agitated. I hadn't sort of properly realised that she was going to die fairly soon. I was, you're still, you know, when you're a partner with someone, I'm still thinking of a sort of a life together, and you never, it's really hard to sort of just imagine that it's going to get cut off in 3 weeks' time or in 2 weeks' time or whenever the time might be. But 3 or 4 weeks out, she was, because she had already moved down from the top floor of our house, and she was moving, she, you know, sitting in the family room. We had her in the front bedroom, so she was all just on one level, could move around. But she used to get this agitation, and she'd tell me that she felt like she was drowning, and it felt like she was being submerged. And, you know, we didn't know what it was, and I, you know, kind of went to the oncologist, and they couldn't sort of say anything at all either about that. But I kind of finally realised what it was, because she was starting to, her mind was brightening. She was starting to see the stillness. It was just naturally starting to come as her body and her organs and all were breaking down, as her body was disappearing, so her mind was brightening. It was really quite a startling thing to see and realise. And I said to her, you know, because she was quite agitated by all of this, and I sort of said to her that, you know, this is what this is, you know, it's the stillness, you know, and we kind of work together just to be able to sort of turn to it and not see it as an enemy, or not see it as something frightening, but to see it as something that's really very beautiful, very containing, and also something very connecting, something that connects you. Which, because she had Diane, this my wife Diane, she had such good karma in that area. She had what I would sort of call good medito. She was able to really share in other people's joy and happiness so very well. And anyway, she took no time at all. It was only a day or so, and this whole thing settled, because she just had this new perspective on being able to sort of see and be with the stillness, because it was just so prevalent for her. And I said to her, you know, this is, the monks and the nuns are down there practicing all the, you know, every day to try and just get to be where you are right here and now, you know. And so she was really quite, you know, quite taken with that, and just stayed with it. And it really settled her and made her so present to the fact that on the day that she died, It was in the evening, and some friends had just sort of walked out of the room, and I walked around to this to her side of the bed where I was just sort of holding her hand, and she'd had a big pain episode that morning, so I'd given her a lot of morphine to sort of settle her, but you know, I'm just very careful about that. She did have she had one of these things up here on a shoulder, so that if we needed to, we could put a morphine pump on there. But happily, she never really ever needed to do that because we managed to contain everything quite well. But anyway, she was sort of fairly well unconscious for some of the morning and that. But in the afternoon, she started to sort of come to. But she wasn't really fully conscious. She was just under a face, and I could talk to her, and she could sort of nod, and she hadn't really opened her eyes. But and all the time through this, I'm saying, "Is the stillness there for you?" And she, "Yeah." Big smile had come on her face. "Yeah, the stillness is there." And so when I came round to this point, when she actually died, you know, the people, the friends had sort of walked out of the room, and I was holding her hand, and she just turned to me. She turned to me. Which she hadn't really done much movement that day, and then her face just looked at it, and she opened her eyes. And it was startling, actually. Her eyes were just so vibrant. They were very, very bright. You know, just really like she was so young again. Those eyes were just, they were just so compelling because they were blue. And she was just looking at me and eyes sparkling and everything like that. And then she just smiled, a big smile came on her face. And then she sort of breathed in like that. And then she just breathed out. And as I was watching her eyes, I just went dead. And that was it. Breathed in and breathed out. She died with this big smile on her face. It was a bit like the cat in Alice in Wonderland. It was just everything had gone except the smile was still there. So, you know, when I think back on that, it gives me great joy, but it also gives me great encouragement that this stillness is something that that we can all know. Diane was never really a Buddhist. She didn't practice that much, but she had a terrific underpinning behind everything. She was probably a better Buddhist than I ever was, but just it shows you that if you kind of want to approach that side of things, you can do it. And what this is, the other thing that I really just wanted to say here with all of this is the fact that when the Buddha talked about all this, you know, when he talked about his practice and just the path of Buddhism itself, he wasn't sort of talking about any belief system or anything like that. He wasn't sort of thinking, he wasn't trying to tell us what to believe in or, you know, because a belief is something, you know, you can believe in any old thing, can't you? People do too. They believe in all sorts of things, you know, which might be right or it might be wrong. But a belief is really just a belief. A belief's kind of something that you don't really know. Whenever I contemplate this myself, you can take it up another level, I think, from belief, and you can start to think about faith. And faith is something too, I think, that, you know, there's probably a lot of hope in faith, where you're starting to develop perhaps a little bit more solidity in your belief. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's right either. I mean, the only thing that you can really ever know that's right is when you really do know. And that's, you know, when we talk about the Buddha, we talk about the one who knows. He's the one who knows. But what is it to know? And this is something that we need to contemplate. Just how do you know? So you can only really know from your own experience. See, Diane, when she died, she knew that stillness. There was no doubt in her mind about that because it was her experience. It was her direct experience. She wasn't intellectualising something and then bringing it in as a belief, as you might. She had there in that context. She had her head, her intellect working, and she had her heart. And this is really what it takes to make an experience real for you, so that you do know what you're what you're experiencing. It's the, you know, the head and the heart. If you kind of, because you can get your emotional side sort of going and just having it run away with you, and without, you know, your intellect to sort of bring it back to some sort of reality, and that's, you know, that's not so good. And also you can have, you know, you can be like an ivory tower sort of professor that's just sort of thinking about everything too, and not ever you know, bringing it back to the reality of an experience. So this way of knowing like that is really important. It's sort of something, I think that does sort of combine the head and the heart together. And it's that knowing that we can start to, where we can start to be confident about what we're seeing and the way that we're practicing. Because when the Buddha discovered Buddhism, he didn't just dream up a belief. He actually uncovered this. He actually saw this in his own mind. It's like a, you know, you could really say probably more like a scientist, where, you know, he was able to see what happened and then test the reality of it. And that's what the Buddha's asking us all to do. You know, he said never really take anything on face value. You need to test everything to see it and know it for yourself. Because if you don't know this stillness for yourself with your own experience, it's, you know, it might be okay to, you know, to sort of have a dogma going like that a bit, but until you know for yourself with your own experience, it's never actually real. So it is important to know that, and also to know that when the Buddha sort of set his pathway up, set his practice of Buddhism up, he was actually looking for a way to unify the mind. He could sort of see that the conditions that we have, the way we live our lives, and the conditioning that we bring in, and the stuff that we believe in and so on, is not necessarily truth, not necessarily truthful. He could see that, you know, conditions are dependent. You know, this is really why he brought out that little wonderful 12-part step of the cycle of dependent origination. You know, how you, the birth and death, and that's how, you know, how he worked out about samsara and just being caught on the wheel of samsara. But just sort of watching this stillness and being able to sort of see this stillness, you start to get an idea of how the Buddha saw that and what he actually noticed with the stillness, because you can see the way that stillness sort of feeds back into your mind all the time, coming back all the time into this present moment. And just how important that is to see. And I'm sort of going to go on in a few moments just to sort of talk a little bit more about that and why that is so important, because, you know, as we'll sort of see in a moment, because this consciousness itself has a propensity to finish. It has a propensity to stop. And that's really exactly what the Buddha saw, and that's what made his teachings really so compelling. So the way that he taught, and actually what we were just doing there with that little practice, that bit of practice, is really we're actually finding a way to calibrate ourselves, to calibrate our mind. So if, you know, we use the breath for a start to anchor yourself to the breath, and then you make yourself more relaxed with that. You can start to settle down and settle right down, until eventually you can get even to the point where you know what the stillness is, and you can actually start to become one with the stillness. So the stillness itself can become like a datum point. And a datum point is something always that you refer back to. So, you know, what the Buddha taught there with his way of meditation, his practice of meditation, was to show us how to anchor ourselves with the most peaceful, still part of our conditioning. so that we can very easily notice the rest, notice the movement of all the rest of the stuff that goes on in our minds. So if you can start to see what this stillness is and then make it a datum point for yourself, you really start to cook with gas, as it was, because then you're really starting to understand what mindfulness is. And mindfulness is just such an important thing. There's a couple of little verses here I brought along to read out for you tonight. First of all, maybe if I can just quote from Ajahn Brahm's teacher, Ajahn Chah. He was quite an amazing monk, really, Ajahn Chah. It was really probably quite an unfortunate death. I can remember when we were here as a society when he first had a stroke, and he ended up living 10 years of his life really in a coma. Ajahn Chah, it was an interesting thing to see, really, a teacher of such renown sort of die like that, because 10 years basically he was in a coma. And but nonetheless, we'd kind of helped him a little bit. We used to sort of send over things like respirators and things like that. But it'd be really good one time to get Ajahn Brahm to sort of speak a little bit more of Ajahn Chah and just some of those experiences, because the monks that looked after him, he was so well looked after, really, for those whole 10 years. He had round-the-clock care and medical hospital treatment, but also care from the monks, who saw some quite extraordinary things, really, that happened there during that time. But anyway, Ajahn Chah, I'm just quoting here from what he says. Ajahn Chah says that sati, that's mindfulness, and really what I'm talking about here, mindfulness, is really just understanding, being mindful of this stillness right in the present moment, being anchored right to this base datum point of stillness. But sati, mindfulness, he says, is essential. He says, without sati, you are crazy. If you are without sati for 5 minutes, you are crazy for 5 minutes. So this is how important he's sort of saying. He was saying this in a retreat situation. He was teaching monks that were in a retreat. He says, when we have sati, we are close to Dharma. If we have sati, we can see anicca, and we will see the Buddha and transcend the suffering of samsara, if not now, then sometime in the future. So this is really just a little point here, just to indicate just how important this is. He's saying it's very close to Dharma. And then he goes on to say, know what it is to be content and discontent, know like and dislike, know appearance and transcendence. The apparent and the transcendent must be realised simultaneously. Good and evil must be seen as coexistent, arising together. This is the fruit of our Dharma practice. So, once again there, he's really just pointing to this mindfulness as just being so important. And you can start to see it. Once that stillness and that the mindfulness of the stillness is there, as I say, it can be there all of the time, then you can start to really notice where your life goes to, where your mind goes to, just where, what it is that what it is that you're practicing for. And to follow that up again with some other points just from the Dharmapada, this is stuff that the Buddha said. He says, the one who delights in mindfulness and who regards unmindfulness with fear advances like fire burning up fetters, gross and subtle. So that's the Dharmapada, verse 31. And the one who delights in mindfulness and who regards unmindfulness with fear is not liable to regression. He is in the presence of Nibbana. So that's verse 32. And then the verse that I like the very best in here when referring to mindfulness is really the one, it's also a verse that there's a monk that used to come here quite a bit called Ajahn Sumedho. He's a wonderful monk. I might just tell you a little bit about him. And Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Sumedho, they've always sort of had a bit of a feisty relationship together because they kind of teach from different ends of the spectrum, if you like. But he used to like this one here, where it says, this is Buddha's words again, heedfulness is the deathless path. Heedlessness, the path to the death. Path to death. Those who are heedful do not die. Heedless are like the dead. That's Dhammapada, verse 21. So you can see that having that level of mindfulness there is very important part of the Buddha's practice. And there are different ways. I just alluded there to the way these two monks come together, because they're both wonderful monks. There's Ajahn Sumedho, who was one of my first teachers here. He used to come here a lot to teach. And he's got a particular way of teaching. And then Ajahn Brahm, you know, over the years that he was especially developing his jhana practices, he's got this sort of natural ability to really know how to absorb the mind, how the mind goes into absorption. He can practice to do that. He has that, seems to have that natural ability to do it. And I wanted to just sort of say a little bit about those two paths to this deep mindfulness, because I think it's quite important to realise, because I think some people have the ability more to do Ajahn Sumedho's way. And then there are other people who would prefer to do it Ajahn Brahm's way. And I think that just to sort of understand really what that means. When Ajahn Brahm talks about absorption, he used to talk about, I can remember here when he was developing it, he used to come here and talk about this ability to take his mind right deep into absorption so that all the hindrances were totally gone. And he would sort of talk about it as sort of, you know, making a run up to a door and then sliding in so that the hindrances just left, and there was just absorption left with the mind, just the mind itself. And this is the stillness, just noticing the stillness of the total mind sort of as he kind of slid in, as it were, so to speak, into this absorption state. And it's interesting sort of contemplating that, because Ajahn Sumedho never really ever taught that way. I don't know that he really ever wanted, whether it was just that he didn't want to or whether or not he just found it easier to practice the other way. But he's, see, because when Ajahn Brahm talks like that, I kind of see him as like a digital monk. This is my kind of emphasis on sort of liking to follow science. See, Ajahn Brahm is a digital monk, and Ajahn Sumedho more as an analog monk, because he kind of just likes to practice with the way of just sort of gently going into the stillness. And there isn't any sort of big, you know, that big sliding effect is not there. Because I think somehow when Ajahn Brahm does his way, he kind of builds up like a latent energy before he goes into the jhana process itself. And with this latent energy that he builds up, that kind of gives the impetus for this sliding effect that he has. Whereas Ajahn Sumedho is really just more, it's like a dial that you're just sort of gradually turning it down. There isn't any sort of jumps as there are, say, with a digital way of sort of seeing it. So both those monks had that sort of different way of teaching it, but I don't think it really matters that much which way you go. It's just, as long as you sort of follow one of them and you can sort of get to use one of them, you're always really in good standing. And the other thing I was just going to mention, though, too, with all this, is really the idea of the why the Buddha put in the prefix of all of his Eightfold Path this right, You know, when you sort of think of the Eightfold Path, it's, you know, right speech, right action, right livelihood, you know, right meditation, right concentration, right mindfulness and right energy, and then right view and right intention. This idea of right, you know, he was giving sort of an idea of a precision that's there. Just really in the same way in science too, there's a precision that you can see there when Isaac Newton first sort of discovered his ideas about the universe. That worked for a long time, and in fact we still use today. We use Newton's equations, you know, quite well. You know, they work quite well in everyday circumstances. But then along came Einstein, and he sort of found that there was a sort of a deeper truth to see, and then he sort of saw the relativity that's there. So he had this idea of relativity, and he realised that you could put himself on a photon of light and sort of move across the whole universe in no time at all. And of course, once he realised that, well, then that really set up his ideas on relativity, and then you get the general relativity with gravity and the rest of it, and all of that became a much more fine and precise way of kind of seeing the universe. And then following that, of course, you have quantum mechanics came along after that, and then that sort of set everything up again, that was even, you know, made everything more weird. But I think that more weird because it's got certain paradoxes in it. But I wanted to just mention one paradox that came out of that quantum mechanics, that came from a thing that Max Planck said. Max Planck was the father of quantum mechanics. And this is really right back in 1918 he said this. He said, "I regard consciousness as fundamental. I regard matter as derivative from consciousness. We cannot get behind consciousness. Everything that we talk about, everything that we regard as existing, is created with consciousness." And I think that sort of fits in with the way that the Buddha taught so well, really, and is really following on from what I'm talking about here. When we are looking into our mind and we're seeing the stillness, we're seeing consciousness. We're seeing pure consciousness. And we can also then start to see how this consciousness too is shaped. We can notice that it's that the conditions that we see in our lives, you know, just our bodies, or the way that Dennis is, the way that you are, what you think about, when you can start to see how your karma presents itself to you, you can start to see where your limitations are, and just what it is that shapes you, what it is that makes you. Once you start to sort of notice this stuff from this still consciousness, you really do start to get an idea of what this idea of samsara, this wheel of conditioning, this wheel of beginning and endings like this is how it works. Because you can see that consciousness itself is driving it all. You know, when we, you know, even just the fact that you're all coming along here and sitting here is really quite a wonderful thing for your consciousness, because you're starting to make your consciousness more peaceful, more subtle. You're starting to sort of move it into a direction where you're sort of moving towards this stillness. And, you know, you can see that when we look at consciousness like that, we've got these two ways that we can go with it. We can certainly... you can certainly see how everything is created through this consciousness, how we create our lives, the different physical things that we create on our planet. Creation is abundant, really, in consciousness. We can do that, but we can also use this knowledge of stillness, this knowledge of pure consciousness, to go to where the Buddha was pointing. That's to go towards peacefulness and stillness. So, you know, you've got these two directions that we can go in. And it probably doesn't take too long. Once you start on this pathway, I think once you're on the Buddhist pathway and you're starting to see how stillness is really such a wonderful thing to be with, such a beautiful thing, such a truthful thing to be with. It's pretty hard to turn away from it. Once, as the Buddha says, the tiger's got you in his mouth, he's really not going to let you go. But nonetheless, you know, there's still very many distractions, isn't there, all the time. We're all the time pulled out of this consciousness in that direction towards all sorts of stuff that we get involved with in the universe. But that precision is really there, what I'm talking about there. It's because it extends not only from the physical universe, but then once it moves into the mental realm, and we know from that, we know what the Buddha told us with that. He told us that in the first verse of the Dhammapada that mind is chief. Mind is the forerunner of all things. And I think that's a fairly well-known thing. You don't probably have to convince too many people about that. You can start to sort of see how the mind runs before everything, runs before the physical, runs before everything. We create, and this is what quantum mechanics is actually showing us too. When we look at this so-called double slit experiment, you can start to see how when you observe something, when you're observing it, you're actually creating it. This what Max Planck was saying there with quantum mechanics. Such it's a weird and wonderful thing. But then as you start to get into Buddhism and you start to notice that same paradox that's there, we start to notice that we are individuals and we've got our own individual conditioning, but yet we're caught into this wider world, this wider universe. And you can start to see that, see how all that's working with the stillness, because when the stillness is sort of coming back, you can see that the whole universe is beginning and ending every moment. You can start to see how it finishes and then creates itself again, and it's feeding back all of the time. The Buddha said trillions of times in the wink of an eye, countless times in the wink of an eye, this consciousness is feeding back on itself. So you start to see how we are involved. We've got this sort of personality, personal kind of view of everything, personal view of ourselves, and we do create our own lives. Every source, if you like, in this universe creates our own life. But at the same time, it's going out and the universe is there, and that's in its turn affecting back again the personal. So the universe is affecting me personally, but at the same time, I'm affecting the universe in my little way as well. We've all, and this is one of the things that quantum mechanics talks about too. It sort of says there that every source, every little thing, everything, every condition that you can think of in the universe has its place. It has its way of affecting. Of the universe would not be the same without every little thing, without every one of us. It takes every one of us to sort of create this universe that's out there that is being fed back inside ourselves. Now I'm just sort of labouring that point there really so that I can just point out to you what happens when you notice that this consciousness finishes. Because that's really, really strange. This is a paradox. Because you only really notice that when you start to get really, really still and you can really see that you really know the stillness beyond any doubt. And when you know that stillness beyond any doubt, then there's a propensity to see that the stillness stops. So what's that like then, when the stillness has stopped? So what that means is that it's no longer feeding back. It means really that the universe has really unified or collapsed back into you as a being, as an individual. And when that universe collapses back like that, it's no longer feeding back. It's no longer feeding the rest of the universe back in. So there's no shaping going on at that point because everything is sort of individual rather than the paradox of being one and the same. Just to explain this a little bit more, I know that it's pretty difficult to see, but it's a bit like a hologram. You know, a hologram is just one of those weird things too that you, if you take a photo of a hologram, say on a glass plate, you know that you can sort of see in three dimensions around a hole. You can sort of turn it and you can see at the back and the front and it because it's all holographic. But if you kind of just drop that plate, if you drop that glass plate on the ground and you just picked up a shard of glass and looked at that hologram there, you would see that the whole picture was still in that shard of glass. That's kind of the nature of a hologram. It's got the, it was there as one in the big thing, but when it's smashed and it's all split up, it's an individual piece then, but it's still got the whole image inside it. And that's kind of a little bit analogous to the way that I see this paradox happening for us with our personality and our individual personality and the wider universe that sort of shapes us. So that when this stillness stops, the universe is in effect unified. And when it's unified like that, you know that when you're kind of looking at your mind, you know that when you die, there's not going to be any rebirth because there's nothing feeding back. There's nothing to shape a rebirth. And you can start to see then very clearly how rebirth happens when we die and that still consciousness is still feeding back. It'll only be a matter of time if that still consciousness is feeding back for the conditions to come in place for a new rebirth to happen. And that's, I think as you get closer to that too, you can start to see that more clearly too. Just in the Buddha was really an expert at that, wasn't he? He was able to sort of say where, people were reborn to and what was going to happen when they died and that sort of thing. He could sort of see that because he had that precision in his mind, that precise way of being able to see things because he had that clarity because of the pure consciousness that he was able to bring to mind. So I'm sort of coming towards the end of what I'm really wanting to talk about there, but I did want to just give you a couple more little examples of just bringing this still consciousness forward all the time and never really ever forgetting about it if you can. It's a bit like when you're doing a CAD program or that, I sort of work on my drawings. If I want to bring something forward, maybe it's a rectangle or something I'm working on, and I want that rectangle to be in front of, say, a circle, or I want it to be in front of something else, you can hit a key and the whole thing will jump to the front. And this is really what we want to do with stillness. We want to jump it to the front all the time, just to keep it first thing in your mind, so that stillness is there as the first filter, so that as we live our lives through the stillness, so that you've actually got that perspective from stillness, rather than a perspective of being sort of caught outside. Because if your perspective's coming from the universe still, and not from this stillness of the mind, then you're caught out there. You really haven't got much of a chance to be able to practice to sort of see what the Buddha saw. So the time's getting on, and I did want to leave some time there for a few questions if you would like to ask some questions. And we'll see what it comes from. I hope it was. I sort of took on a bit of a talk tonight that was a little bit complicated. I hope it wasn't too complicated for you. That you may be able to sort of get some value out of what's being said. Has anyone got any questions? Yeah. There's a microphone coming to you.
Thank you, Dennis. I've had a very, very difficult week with my father and Centrelink and all sorts of other red tape and doctors, and it's just so wonderful to come here tonight and every Friday night, but particularly tonight after a really harrowing week, and to just be able to let go and just to feel that incredible stillness that you talk about, that I experience. And it is, it's just so wonderful that that gift is there all the time if we remember it and we're able to, you know, to take advantage of it and to, I mean, I often meditate, but to come here, it's just, it's so incredibly peaceful and beautiful, and my heart just really melts when I come here, and I thank you very much, and for everyone that I think we all share that, and it's a very, very wonderful gift that we have. So thank you.
Thanks for that too, and thanks for those comments. And the thing that I'd add with that too is that this stillness, once you kind of know where it is and just how what it, you know the experience of it yourself in your own mind, you'll find that it is a healing thing. It's a wonderful healer, as I'm sure you would attest to, really, with the as I know a little bit about your circumstances. But because this pure consciousness is so fine, it penetrates everything. It penetrates all of the conditions. Because it's pure consciousness, there's nothing that can really escape its penetration. So consciousness will penetrate into, this pure consciousness will penetrate into everything. And if you allow it to, it kind of, and you can stay with the consciousness, it'll just break it up. So if there's, if you've got, say, problems with, you know, maybe even illnesses, but certainly just start back with the more gentler things like, maybe just pains or headaches, things like that. You'll find that if you can just turn your attention to the stillness and bring whatever problem you've got into that stillness, and allow it, the stillness will penetrate and break it up. In fact, I do this quite often in my hypnosis practice. It's really, Ruth mentioned that I've kind of developing this modality called stillness healing, and it's quite a wonderful thing to sort of see, really, just how that does work for people, how many of life's troubles and trials and tribulations, once stillness is brought to bear on it, they really don't stand much of a chance. I mean, it's certainly not going to stop us all from, eventually living our lives and sort of, moving through the cycle of life. Doesn't sort of prevent death or anything like that, but it certainly gives you the right perspective on the way that we should see things. The way that what the Buddha talked about, right view. You know, when we start to see this, is this idea of this precision that he was talking about by putting that prefix of right in front of all those the Noble Eightfold Path items that he specified. And so thank you for that. Anyone else?
Hello, thank you. I just want to go back to that point you made about, I think this is how I heard it. That idea of stillness, that point, through the practice of meditation, that's where we go. That's the purpose of it. So when I'm living my day-to-day life and, you know, I'm getting a little bit ruffled, or, you know, you're just living life and dealing with people who are not living the way that you're striving for, bringing that stillness to the fore, is that what you're saying? If you bring consciously that stillness to the fore, it is easier to exist or to be in that space. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
And the more that you practice it, the easier it is to bring it forward.
Mm. It's actually essential, because the more you practice it, the more you'll see that the stillness exists with the conditions. It's actually at the back, you know, the stillness is actually, for most of us, the stillness is kind of wound up inside of all of the conditions. The still consciousness is there, wrapped up in it all. It's wrapped up in the whole universe. And by teasing that out, by practicing to be able to see that stillness, then you can actually bring that up as a first filter. So the first thing you see through is the stillness, and then you're looking on to the conditions, and then you've got the right perspective. You can actually see how all the conditions are made from the stillness, so you can make good choices. You can decide, oh yes, I'm going to create this or create that. You know, you can use the stillness in that way to enrich your life in many ways, to create a life for yourself that's beneficial and happy, trouble-free. Or, you know, you can even go, you can certainly make it troublesome too if you want to, but coming back the other way, you can also make your life along the pathway that the Buddha talked about, so that you're starting to let go, and then starting to get closer towards what he was pointing to, you know, towards what enlightenment is, when actually everything does stop. It's an interesting point just to note that too. When the Buddha talked about stopping, he quite often, if you might remember the story of Angulimala, when Angulimala was chasing him, I won't go into the story now, but anyway, Angulimala was a man that wanted to kill the Buddha, and he was chasing him to kill him, and he was... But he couldn't catch the Buddha. The Buddha seemed to be striding on in front of him. And I don't know if the story is apocryphal or just how it sort of fits into the suttas, but nonetheless, that's how it's kind of recorded. And Angulimala is yelling out, "Stop, Buddha, stop!" And the Buddha turned to Angulimala and says, "I have stopped, Angulimala. It's you who needs to stop." So, you know, in a very real way, and in sort of many other examples too in the suttas, he was sort of talking about this idea of stopping. But the idea, that's where this paradox so brilliantly comes in to see, because you can stop and see consciousness stop, but, you know, as it probably was for the Buddha for the whole, you know, how long was he enlightened for? 40 years or something like that he taught. So for that whole period of time, you know, you could say that really his life or his consciousness, as it kind of went out into the world to, you know, to come back and rejig his karma all the time, and had stopped. So there was no chance that he was ever going to be reborn, and because he'd sort of developed to the point where he was this arahat, and it was impossible for him to make karma anymore, because it's not being kind of pulled in from the... I hope that's clear. I mean, I know it's very difficult to explain, actually. It's a sort of... I hope you get the feel for it. Yes, yeah. I think that's not a bad way to see it. I think the mind really is the whole universe. Yes.
Right. So when we talk about our mind, we're talking about an individual mind when you've been talking about this now.
Mm-hmm.
And consciousness is the vast everything. Is that
true? Well, the the pure consciousness is both in your individual mind, but it's also extends right out into the entire universe.
So we're really talking about the same thing. Mind,
yeah.
Consciousness is the same, but we individualise the mind.
Yes.
Yeah, it's just terms I'm getting confused
with. Yeah, yeah, I know terms are difficult.
I just want to make sure that I understood correctly.
Yeah.
It's talking about this stillness. The goal of the stillness, so the goal of us is to get the stillness.
Mm-hmm.
If we do, we don't come back again. We don't reborn again, right? So if you get the point that you actually get this stillness through the meditation or whatever, that means that I will, or like in my case, let's say that I regret it, I will not reborn again because you get this point in your life?
Yeah, it's, well, it's not, yeah.
And if so, what happened with the karma that I produce the rest of, like, the three quarters of my previous life, let's say? Yeah.
Where's it all gone to?
Yeah, I'm really worried about it.
Yeah, well, stillness is, when stillness is there, the stillness is feeding back. There's, you know, the universe is just normal. The only thing you've just noticed there, though, is just the what the conditions of the universe is made from. You can see that the conditions of the universe is penetrated by the stillness, but by the still consciousness. But the... To get to the point, though, where the rebirth doesn't work, you really need to practice to the point where, and to be aware enough to know that the stillness has stopped. This is another. Another step. It's not really because the universe is perfect just the way that it is. You know, this just the way that it is right now. It's perfect. There's not a there's no inconsistencies anywhere really in it all. The only inconsistency is with us and the karma that we make and the dukkha that we generate from the karma. You know what I mean by dukkha? When the Buddha was questioned on this...
No, I didn't understand. What do you mean by dukkha?
Dukkha.
Dukkha. What's that? Yeah.
Oh, dukkha is like the suffering that comes from life. You know, it's really inescapable. No matter what we do, there'll always be a level of, you know, even in the, and Cha was sort of pointing to there, and even in sort of times of great happiness, you know, there are the seeds of sadness and trouble in all of that. You know, there's really nothing in the universe where we find perfection, because it's always shot through with this, what the Buddha called dukkha, this unsatisfactoriness, you know, the fact that things are never quite right, because there's always this paradox kind of working, and because of that, it makes everything uncertain. You know, you can't really bank on anything really in the world. But and it's, and I just wanted to make the point there too that the Buddha. For those that are still remaining, the Buddha talked about himself as a Tathagata. A Tathagata, he said. This is what how he described himself, Tathagata, and it really means one that has thus come, and one that has thus gone. He's actually pointing there to a really balanced mindfulness. And actually, there was a Ajahn Amaro, who was a disciple of Ajahn Sumedho's. He's got a terrific way of explaining this with the Tathagata, because Tathagata is a Pali word that means that when you sort of pronounce it as Tathagata, it means thus come. But if you go Tathagata, no, that's the way around. Tathagata means thus come. But Tathagata means thus gone. So it was a really, really interesting play that the Buddha sort of made with this word Tathagata. And when he was doing that, sort of, he actually got a fair bit of criticism. You know, people just, you know, I think at the time they were sort of saying that he is kind of, you know, claiming himself to be, you know, a god or something like that. And so there was this kind of this sutta that sort of arose from that, where the Buddha spoke to that and spoke to the critics that were criticizing him. And it was called the misrepresentation of the Tathagata. And what the Buddha said to address that whole thing was that he said, "Bhikkhus, both formerly and now, what I teach is suffering and the cessation of suffering." So that's was the word that he used. So that's what he's teaching, this dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. And this can all be sort of seen with this stillness, this mindfulness. Anyone else? We call it quits? Oh, thank you. We'll pay respects to the Buddha and the Dharma in the Sangha. Araham Samma Sambuddho Bhagavata Buddham Bhagavantam Abhivadeni Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhamman Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Svavaka Sangho Sangam Namami.